Hello and welcome to The Dorothy Project, the interview podcast celebrating women's impact on queer culture. My name's Alice Beverton-Palmer and I'm a DJ, campaigner and general gadabout. For our last episode of season three, I'm talking to the fashion lecturer and PR, Tony Gill. I first met Tony when he introduced me to the Bollywood director, Shelly Chopradar, who was one of my favourite interviewees in season two. If you haven't listened to her episode, I really recommend going back for a listen. Tony's British Asian upbringing gave him a whole different set of gay icons to the ones I grew up with, so I couldn't wait to ask him about them.
The Dorothy Project with Alice Beverton-Palmer.
You initially did a law degree.
I did. It was something that my parents had sort of prescribed and mapped out for me. And I didn't really think about it sort of through my schooling years. Yeah, I was aware there were other things that I would much rather have followed. Fashion at one point, or social work. But it wasn't what was inevitably kind of prescribed for me. So I went up to Manchester. They were great formative years, a bit of a culture shock. Coming from, you know, a pretty traditional Sikh family unit, I was there for 5 years, and I inevitably began the coming out process in the final couple of years of being there. I came back deciding not to pursue law. I figured that quite early on. You know, I was, you really have to want to study it. I found it tedious, just kind of, you know, memorizing cases and statutes and whatever. It wasn't for me. I was in the library, I think, once at the end of each term, photocopying an entire term's worth of notes from one of my peers. I was so not into it. And at that point, I thought, you know what, I really want to be doing journalism. So I came back, worked for a year, and then did communications and audiovisual production, which kind of led into journalism post a stint at a TV production company as an office runner, which I absolutely hated in the heart of Soho. Yeah, it was a great. It was Rapido TV that did like Euro Trash and
was it in that era?
It was kind of, I think, when Euro Trash was kind of, it was sort of dying its death,
right?
Victim of its own success a little bit, and they were doing a lot of other quite crass stuff for like UK Living, and it's when the internet was sort of taking off and they were putting a lot of investment into the website. I didn't really work. And I'd kind of jumped ship before that. I started as an office runner, and I was terrified. You know, I had a weekend job in Harvey Nichols while I was studying. Coming towards the end of my degree, I was having a massive panic about getting a job in media. And a friend's boyfriend was a production runner at Rapido at the time, said they're looking for an office runner. And I got the job. And it was tedious. It wasn't even getting hands-on experience on a production, because I was kind of setting up desks for production teams as a new production was starting, cleaning out the toilets, you know, walking the head of production's dog at lunchtime, you know, getting lunches. And I was kind of thinking, oh God, is it what I've kind of studied to be doing? But, you know, I think a bit of an epiphany was one Monday morning where we were based on Great Pulteney Street, and someone over the weekend had kind of pissed in the sort of fire exit doorway, and it had seeped through to like the fire hazard carpet, you know, inside. And I had to like pull up this carpet on a Monday morning thinking, oh my God, I'm telling myself it's character building. And then I was kind of promoted to work on the website, more checking, you know, that we had legal clearance on content that we wanted to use.
You were using your degree at that point?
A little bit. It was just basically going back to check all the kind of clearance forms of certain episodes of Euro Trash and whatever, to check we were okay to use that content on the website. a lot of egos, and it was, yeah, I mean, I was there for 9 months, and there was, you know, a positive in that time period was having a short story published in the Gay Times Book of Short Stories that was based around my living a bit of a double life up in Manchester before I came out. That was quite special during that time, you know, and went up to Manchester to give a reading at the Waterstones up there. So it was kind of, yeah, back to the scene of the crime, really.
Wow, because I was going to say, it's really hard sometimes when you start a creative degree and lots of people you graduated with have gone into corporate stuff. And it's so well paid and like respectable, and you're like cleaning piss out of carpets for like some tiny salary.
Totally.
But if you're already like published, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, I didn't really. It was great, and I'm not very good at kind of acknowledging my achievements, and I think that may stem from I don't know, and I completely appreciate where it was coming from, but never kind of. Applauded for our achievements as kids. It's like, you can do better. You know, GCSE results weren't good enough. A-level results weren't good enough. I, you know, it didn't come from a bad place. But I think our parents, and more so our mum, thought that that would motivate us to do better. So you can't, but you do kind of grow up feeling a bit inadequate, a bit of a non-achiever, and hard to kind of recognize when you do achieve.
Yeah. And even if it does make you do better, if you're like if you're like crippled with not being able to recognize that, that's really hard.
Yeah. And I guess kind of, I grew up lacking a lot of self-esteem and confidence, and a sense of self-worth. It wasn't, we felt loved, you know, but I think my schooling years were a little bit damaging, and took quite a long time to sort of, I guess, work through the insecurities that you know, those years ingrained in me. You know,
what kind of school did you go to?
So I went to an all-boys private school. Again, you know, our parents, you know, as first generation migrants, it was, you know, it was all about kind of sacrificing for the kids and us having the best possible lives moving forward. They had struggled immensely as first generations and generation migrants, you know, coming from, you know, sort of dad's family. They owned farms in Kenya and East Africa. Mum was a teacher in India. They came over, they were working in factories and initially, you know, renting a room with our older brother in a house in Croydon before getting onto the property ladder. But so it was very much about, you know, getting my older sister and I through private schooling, particularly after our brother kind of fucked up royally at state school. There are three of us siblings. I'm the youngest. And, you know, it was a real struggle for our mum to pay our fees. You know, I remember her saying, like, she had 60 quid a month left to herself after paying our fees. And I think I didn't want to go to this school. And it was, you know, I felt inferior on so many kind of levels in terms of I was shit at competitive sports. I felt financially inferior. I was this geek in a turban and AHS specs and, you know, was bullied. And in hindsight, I do think, fuck, I made it through those years. So kind of, I guess it's testament to sort of our resilience and our resources. To kind of survival resources.
Yeah.
But it, you know, I did grow up very much being a bit of a chameleon, and a lot of code switching, to protect myself, I guess. You know, as a gay man, very much just trying to put on a front of being straight, you know, probably to an extreme in terms of, you know, giving it the large and saying, oh, that girl's fit and whatever, because I really wanted to project.
So like hyper masculine.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And if a friend said, oh, you're such a puff or whatever, it would mortify me. I was like, oh my God, is it that obvious? You know, I was aware through my schooling years that I fancied guys, but it wasn't going to factor into my life, so it wasn't an issue. Apart from
because
the kind
everything
of
was kind of set, so yeah, that was just what was going
to
happen.
And more so, I mean, I wanted to get married and have a family, and had these very naive notions of, you know, I'm going to be an amazing, completely committed husband and dad and whatever. That's what I wanted my life to be about. And leading into those university years, and I submerged myself in a hardcore Asian scene when I got there because I wanted a crew. So, I mean, I had friends through my schooling years outside of school, my largely female, well, actually, no, it was kind of mixed, boys and girls from the temple, my pals from the temple. But I guess I was always closer to girls, and I guess taking it back a step to my primary school years where, you know, I'd hang out with, you know, the, not the mean girls, but the, you know, the pretty, the quiet, the, you know, the it girls of primary school.
The it girls of primary school, yeah, that's amazing. Like, but I know exactly what you mean. It's like, it's such a cliche that you have like the most popular girls, yeah, and then there's, yeah, like the a gay sidekick.
Yeah, you know, and again, I think those years before you're aware of gender conformity were quite openly, you know, we'd dance to kind of like, you better shape up on the climbing frame, you know, or pretend we were Charlie's Angels and I was Farah. Never Sabrina, she was too geeky.
You now work with big Bollywood stars, they're, yeah, kind of full circle, yeah. Like, how does that feel?
See, again, I think my business partner and I, and again, she's an incredible inspiration, a very strong woman.
How did you know,
a feminist. We met from an agency that I worked at previously, and she was editing a women's magazine at the time. I met her, through that. We lost touch, and then when I set up my agency, we reconnected. I bumped into her. She was doing some freelance PR at that point. Joined us a couple of days a week, and you know, we became business partners inevitably. We share the same values, ethically, spiritually. I think, you know, she's a very strong feminist and an inspiration. Again, I don't think that there are lots of things that I find it hard to recognize the achievements. Like, you know, I did have a problematic relationship with alcohol and drugs, more so the alcohol. I did do AA. I did have an issue with standing up and sharing and saying, I'm Tony, I'm an alcoholic. Not because I was in denial, but I just felt that I had a problematic relationship. Maybe that is still being an addict, but yeah, it was just out of control. I didn't have boundaries when I did it, and you know, I haven't drank or done anything like that for over 13 years now, and again, thank you, but yeah, I don't, where my friends, who bless them, you know, I put them through some shit over the years, I think, you know, a catalyst also being mum's death at the time when I got back from Manchester, various factors, I guess, but they, you know, they didn't ever desert me. Yeah, I pissed them off, and some of them, I was in the doghouse sometimes for several months where they couldn't speak to me, but they stood by me. And when they tell me, when, you know, like, wow, that's incredible, I don't know if I see it as incredible, and even very blessed to be working with all the people, okay, different generations. We have worked with some of those, my icons from the 70s, but, you know, it's part of our work, and we get on with it and feel incredibly blessed, yeah, when I take stock, but I guess we just get on with it. Rather than be like, hey, look at us, we're not very good with kind of self-recognition or appreciation, but I think that's not necessarily a bad thing. Just do what you're doing. You know, and if it gets recognition as a byproduct, that's great and that's very sweet, but it's not the it's not our motivation.
And when you look at the like Bollywood scene now, like obviously the kind of subject matter of Bollywood movies is getting more diverse. You know, I've interviewed, thank you to you, the director of a big commercial movie about a lesbian love story. But like, are there any stars now who are those kind of gay icons?
I would, yeah, I'm sure there are both male and female. I think that's more a question for maybe younger generations of Asian gay men and lesbians, or, you know, I'm sure there are. Because, I mean, Bollywood cinema has evolved. And again, even though there's it still very much does reaffirm a certain status quo. You know, there's a long way to go. But I think in terms of it still being a bit of a fantasy world, you know, I think there's definitely icons. And I think, again, whether they're playing the characters that we need representation of in Indian cinema just by their being who they are as Bollywood actors and celebrities and icons is perhaps enough. There are younger Asian gay guys who I can so see what Bollywood means to them now, and whatever, I can understand their attachment to it and how, you know, what it's probably allowed for a lot of survival, you know, having this escapist fantasy world where things are fine compared to like the reality of things being a bit shit when you're growing up, when you're battling with your sexuality, with coming out, because as South Asians as well, it's so, you know, there's that fear of everything that you've grown up, that you hold dear, your faith, your family, the you know, the community network. You know, there's a lot of fear of being rejected from all of that. Your family, you know, being rejected by the faith, which isn't true, but you grow up kind of thinking that that it is, and you're terrified of being rejected. I think it, whether Bollywood's conscious of it or not, I think it does, it's allowed, yeah, it's been a bit of a coping strategy for a lot of young Asian gays and lesbians, I think. You know,
it's that whole icon thing, because obviously you see it in like Western pop music,
yeah.
You see it in so many places. So,
yeah.
Yeah, that kind of like the star who's able to, like you say, be feisty, be strong,
yeah,
be feminine,
yeah.
And everything works out at the end.
Yeah, totally, totally.
Yeah.
It's, yeah, the narratives where usually, again, I mean, the cinema, you know, it's evolving a lot, you know, but traditionally the fact that it would come full circle and there would be this happy ending and you know that everything's going to be okay, you know, and I guess one would carry that out of the cinema or, you know, the relative's front room with them, do you know what I mean?
Yeah totally.
Even
like people talk about like Disney gays. And that's fairy tale,
yeah,
like,
totally.
And all the music and
absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. You know, it is still, you know, I would love the costumes and the hair and makeup, and, you know, I used to, rarely seldom did I get treated to an LP, like the film soundtrack. And I would just get drawn to the most glamorous, like, I might not know the film, but it would have to have a contemporary actress looking fabulous. They were a work of art in themselves, the album artwork. You'd have you'd have sort of pop-up ones and like loads of layers of, loads of stills from the film, you know, and yeah, they were great. And yeah, half the attraction was the packaging, basically. how superficial.
No, that's fair. Yeah, sounds amazing.
It could be absolutely shit. So packaging was fabulous.
Frame them.
Yeah.
And in terms of, like, you've talked a bit about the gay scene being a bit clony.
Yeah.
Was it difficult to like find a home like as a Asian gay man and bring those two together?
I think in terms of my experience, I was quite naive about the Manchester scene. And then I was heading back to London, again, very naively thinking, oh, you know, the great gay fraternity is going to embrace me with open arms. And I worked for a year in sort of fashion retail, high fashion retail before doing my London degree, and was doing the Soho scene, and I found it a little bit pretentious. And then when I was doing my London degree, I had this weekend job in men's contemporary Harvey Nichols, like, you know, the gayest department of the store. So we'd go, colleagues and I would hang out in Soho after work and whatever. And again, I felt a little bit of an outsider looking in. I didn't feel archetypally attractive to gay men. You know, I wasn't a Caucasian muscle queen with blue eyes or whatever. But you sort of find your pockets. Even going out, I loved the kind of provincial Croydon scene, which was a bit crass and cheesy, but, you know, you could just have a laugh, a down-to-earth laugh. I did do the kind of the Gaysian scene a bit, which I loved. I loved going with straight female friends and us having a laugh and having a club night where we could dance to Bollywood songs or whatever. But I couldn't necessarily relate to a lot of these guys. Maybe because I was lucky that I felt comfortable enough to come out to the community, to my family, to my network. I feel maybe a lot of these guys maybe didn't have that opportunity or didn't feel that they could do that. So maybe it became an arena where it was one of the few spaces where they could express that element of their identities. And I felt it became a bit caricature, and it scared me a little bit. I felt there was a lot of kind of in-bitching and stuff, and it was all a little bit kind of political in terms of drag queen wars or whatever, a little bit is my experience of it. So I couldn't necessarily relate to many of the guys that I met on that scene, you know. But again, it was an incredible scene, and it was a different generation then as well.
That was going to be my next question, like, how you think it's changed over the years.
So I mean, I would like to think that it's like, hopefully, a lot of kind of young Asian gay men and women, things are easier for them in terms of, it's never easy, but you know, that they would feel confident enough to come out, maybe more so than, you know, a couple of decades ago, and even before that. So hopefully they have. I mean, there was one club night, Hangama, which we discovered. Again, when I stopped drinking and whatever, I became a bit socially, socially reclined.
Like, you stepped back a bit from it?
I completely stepped back and you know, more recently there might be the odd night, you know, where I might go out for dance with friends, And I had heard about this night called Hungama, and it was great because it was, it felt, the music was great. It was a great crowd. It reminded me of the kind of trashy East London gay scene that I was doing years later, like your kind of Joiners Arms, George and Dragon. You know, I was like, oh my God, I can really relate to this, even though I feel like midlife crisis, like a bit fucking like the dad in the room.
Dad or daddy?
Well, yeah, not sugar daddy, but daddy, you know, a bit old for it, but it was like, wow, this is great. And I think the scene has really evolved a lot. But yeah, I did get coming back to sort of the scene, like when started doing the East London scene, which felt a lot more down to earth, less pretentious than say Soho. But I worked for the gay press as well for 7 years, where we had constant battles with our publishers, who were a couple of aging muscle queens, you know, and it was always a Caucasian muscle Mary on our front cover with his top off, you know. Then that kind of evolved into a Caucasian male celebrity with his top off on the cover. Our club pages could have been the same club night, every issue, you know, dilated pupils, you know, sort of bottle of water in a jean pocket, you know, six pack. I felt, look, surely we're in a position to kind of broaden gay men's horizons. But I also used to question, well, who reads this as a publication? Because in London, Cosmopolitan gay men, they're probably reading Men's Fitness or GQ or whatever. And this is kind of like, you know, the early 2000s. I was like, I don't listen to Kylie. I don't listen to Madonna. So I'm not going to put them on my music pages because I'm not going to duplicate what they can read in all of the rest of the gay press, perhaps. So I put in hip hop and stuff that I like to listen to. You know, and the magazine, sadly, you know, it's symptomatic of the publishing world, but it closed because it couldn't sustain itself, you know, hence the kind of transition to PR. I felt in those kind of years that there wasn't perhaps a place. I remember in the past, you know, sort of having times of thinking, you know, God, if I was, why couldn't I have been Asian and straight? Or if I was going to be gay, white, to feel desirable, you know. And I'm coming to learn that maybe this is a universal thing with gay men, straight men, whoever, you know. From the apps, it's like, you know, for a booty call, just, you know, it's like not punching above, feeling like you can't punch above your weight because you don't stand a chance. And if you're feeling a bit horny, going for someone who you think is going to be a safe, easy bet rather than someone who you necessarily think, yeah.
The fact that, like, you know, no fats, no femmes, no Asians is fact that that's like this cliche is just terrible.
It's, yeah. And you would, you know, I remember, you know, that, gosh, when I, it merged from the kind of almost like kind of hot tickets, a supplement that came out with Evening Standard would have like a kind of lonely men seeking men section, then Time Out. And I'd go on dates through that, if not through sort of, I don't know, you know, meeting someone in a bar or whatever, to Gaydar, where, you know, it would be so prescriptive in terms of, and I would often think, you know what, like, why do you have to list what you don't like? Just talk about what you do like or whatever and stuff, you know. And okay, if you don't fancy someone, you don't fancy them for whatever reason.
And a question that everyone gets, who else do you think I should speak to, either as a Dorothy like Shelley or as a friend of Dorothy like you?
I think as a Dorothy, I think the actress Sonam Kapoor, who played the female lead in Ek Ladki Ko Dekha To Aisa Laga, Shelley's film, because she's also, you know, a bit of an LGBTQ activist and advocate. I think she'd be a good person to speak with.
It sounds like she's had a really powerful impact in, like, given her position, that she's able to like
absolutely
set the terms a bit.
Absolutely. Regardless of how, you know, what sort of praise or criticism, you know, from, you know, your more traditional, you know, sort of or conservative sort of elements of society were going to receive it, you know, the fact that, you know, she was like, this film and this message needs to, you know, go out, regardless of kind of what the reaction was going to be. So kind of taking a stand and, you know, fighting the corner. She's also a gay icon in terms of she's a very strong woman of substance and a style icon. So she's fabulous. Like
she's got it all. Like,
yeah, she's got it all. Absolutely. You know, she's she does the Cannes red carpet and always, yeah. So she's, yeah, she's pretty fabulous as well as, yeah, being a strong female voice and personality that's come out of Indian cinema recently.
Every time I hear people talk about Bollywood, it makes me want to work back through decades of classic movies. Well, maybe that's what maternity leave is for. And on that note, this is the last episode of The Dorothy Project for now, as I'm off to raise a tiny baby. I have absolutely loved all 23 of the interviews I've done so far. Since I started The Dorothy Project in 2019, it has been the biggest privilege to meet so many interesting, inspiring people, to hear their stories and their take on the world, and to meet people who listen to the podcast. It's a wonderful surprise and always the best conversations. So thank you for listening. It truly means the world to me. Every Dorothy and every listener has had an impact on me, and I hope that goes both ways. So thank you and goodbye for now. Stay safe, be yourself, question the status quo, and fuck the patriarchy. This episode of The Dorothy Project featured Tony Gill as our guest. This episode and the series was hosted by Alice Beverton Palmer and produced by Laura Blake.